So today I'm interviewing James Valiant, kind of based off of his book, Creating Christ, and we got questions about that. You assert that Christianity was invented by Roman emperors as a way to pacify the Jews who were rebelling against Roman rule. I see merit to this argument. And then historically, the Roman Catholic Church, the way that came to be under the influence of Constantine, his conversion, how he conquered in the name of the cross and the Catholic Church down through the Dark Ages, through Crusades, Inquisitions, and pogroms. You can see how it was used as an instrument of, Roman government, and then as it became its own entity, just like Catholicism. So there may be well an Orwellian plot to subdue the Jewish revolution of the first century. Before we get into the merits of that, I'm going to kind of ask your background and then start to build the case for that. So would you mind telling our audience, I guess, what educational background or what brought you to studying the biblical literature of the New Testament? What's your background in that, and what led you on the journey to, I guess, develop this idea? If you would give an intro on that.
Sure. For almost 18 years, I was a public prosecutor, a deputy district attorney here in California. And so my educational background for that was a Juris Doctorate, as you might imagine. Before that, I studied at New York University, history and philosophy. And I have a degree in philosophy from NYU, magna cum laude. But my interest in this began even before that. I was raised in a Christian family, not a terribly religious family, but from early childhood, I was very interested in the religion that my parents casually took me to church to study. And they took me to Sunday school, but I got into it. And I got into it in a way that I think just sort of disturbed my parents. I was far more religious than they were about it. They were primarily taking me there for the moral instruction. They didn't much buy into the church authority or the metaphysics of it, and all the religious folderol. So, but he'll grow out of it, they thought. And I think that I did grow out of it. But because I had been so interested, I read and I read and I read and I kept reading voluminously on this. So it has mostly been my extracurricular avocation, if you will, to study this material. But I've been studying it since in depth since I was a teenager. The first inklings I had, and I mean studying the scholarship on it and so forth, in some depth. And my first inkling on this theory happened way back in the early 1980s, about 40 years ago, when I was reading Josephus, the Jewish historian, who was working for the Romans. And he makes it plain that the Roman government was using the Jewish messianic religion of the rebels at the time for their own propagandistic purposes. He was, in effect, a Roman propagandist, as well as nominally, at least, a Jew still. But it does indicate, beyond a reasonable doubt in my mind, that the Romans were aware of this self-consciously and using the rebels' religion against them. Now, to set the context, of course, we have the Jewish rebellions of the first and second century. And these are characterized as intensely messianic, intensely apocalyptic, intensely Torah orthodox, nationalist, separatist. And if you look at it that way, and militant, they were rebels. If you look at it that way, the New Testament on the face of it looks like a critical reaction to the messianic Judaism of the rebels. And of course, it makes good sense that we would see large Hellenistic features now, Greco-Roman elements introduced into Christianity that are wholly alien to Judaism. And that's exactly what we do see. The elbow in the road between Christianity and Judaism is just that. And you started out with some really good points.
Yeah, I wanted to get into I'll start asking you questions to kind of build this thing.
Sure.
But I wanted to kind of lay some foundational work, and then
Sure.
I'm going to ask you questions and hopefully draw out all that you're in the direction you're going right now. But I mean, it's all really good stuff, and it's important, it's interesting. So did you get a chance to watch the video that I did the interview with Dr. Robert Price?
I did watch a large section of it. You gave me the time, but I went well before and well after. So I got the whole context of his discussion when you do talk about my work, when you ask him about it.
So yeah, based off of that, he seems to think, well, he doesn't, because I asked about your work, and we'll get into this a little later, the work Atwill does on Caesar's Messiah. He doesn't feel that there's room, or you address the idea of a historical Jesus within the creating Christ myth. It seemed like he didn't think that was necessary. And so before we get into the nuts and bolts of, you know, the creating Christ, I was curious, is there room for historical Jesus? And what do you think of Bart Ehrman's view on whether Jesus exists or not?
I'm a historicist. So just to flatly lay that out, I believe there was a Jesus movement before the anti-rebel forces got their hands on it. Before the Greek-speaking and writing Christians got their hands on it, there was a Jesus, authentic Jesus movement. I tend to agree, and this is my difference with Bart Ehrman, although I do agree with Bart Ehrman that there was a historical Jesus. Now, in our book, Creating Christ, we do not take a stand on it. We don't really think that's the key question here. If there was a historical Jesus, he was almost certainly the exact opposite of the guy depicted in the New Testament.
Yeah.
In Greek Christian texts, he would just be the exact. What they did is they turned a guy who was crucified as a rebel under the Romans, and a guy who was claiming to be the king of the Jews because he was descendant of David, they turned that guy into a pacifist internationalist who said, "My kingdom isn't even of this earth," a startling statement from the Messiah, because obviously the Jewish rebels of the period were expecting a perfectly earthly Messiah to lead them to victory over Rome. So I believe, unlike Bart Ehrman, I believe in a rebel Jesus, more like Professor Brandon, the person that Robert Price cited in the interview. I have some disagreements with Professor Brandon, but in general, not about this. I think that while we don't take a stand on the historical Jesus, my own personal view is that there was a historical Jesus. We make very clear, though, in the book that we're not talking about the creation. This is my main objection to Price's criticism. He says the whole religion created by, we're not making that claim. We're not making the claim that there was no authentic Jesus movement before our Greek Pauline Christians got their hands on it. Our theory is perfectly consistent with that. We just didn't even want to enter into that debate. My own personal view is that that's exactly what happened. And in fact, it becomes a stronger argument for our case of Roman provenance. How could a rebel have been turned upside down, inside out, and on his head, except intentionally? So I'm a historicist like Bart Ehrman in the sense that I don't regard Christian texts as historically reliable. Indeed, I had a conversation with Bart Ehrman that was a podcast. Another podcaster gave me a chance to have a wonderful conversation. I've had multiple conversations with him in podcasts. But my first conversation, I simply asked Bart Ehrman, do you agree that the passion narrative, the story of the execution of Jesus, is itself fact or fiction? Because it looks to me like political, distinctly political parable. The betrayal of Judas, the conviction by the Sanhedrin, Pilate in all four gospels saying he's innocent, the crowd in all four gospels demanding Jesus's execution. In the Gospel of Mark, he has the crowd announcing in unison, apparently, his blood is on us and on our children. Anti-Semitism is grounded in this story of the gospels. And this is clearly political parable in my view. If the Romans killed Jesus, it was because they believed him to be a political threat. If Jesus was anything like the dude in the Gospels, they would have given him a soapbox. They wouldn't have executed him. Pay your taxes, peace, turn the other cheek, go the extra mile for the Romans. Yeah. So not only does the wider context suggest it, but the parable suggests it. And Bart Ehrman perfectly agreed with me. He agreed that the passion narrative is fiction. Mm-hmm. And it was fiction designed to exonerate the Romans, in effect, and blame the Jews for the death of Jesus, as it systematically does in a parable-like fashion. So if we understand that the bone structure of all four Gospels, passion narrative, what they share, the Jews are responsible, in effect, they're saying in a heavy-handed way, three times the crowd demands, and poor Pilate, you know, I wash my hands of this in almost a cartoonish fashion. If we believe that the passion narrative is fiction, like Bart Ehrman and I agree, and if we agree that it's political parable, then I don't think that it's sufficient to say that Jesus, the Jesus story was not altered significantly, and altered significantly for political reasons, if that makes sense.
It does. And that's, we'll get into that more. And I think there's definitely a lot of merit to that. So you saw Josephus as a propagandist, essentially, for the Roman government. The early followers, you characterize them as militant rebels. Dr. Price thinks that the reference, though, by Josephus was added later, where he references James, the brother of Jesus, the one they call Christ or whatever. He feels like that was added by Eusebius.
Well, there are two passages which mention Jesus in Josephus's Antiquities. One is a reference to the execution of James, the brother of Jesus, the so-called Christ, which is one reference in Josephus. And then there's the famous testimonium where he discusses Jesus. Now, most scholars believe that that testimonium section has been altered. They don't believe it was created from scratch, although some do. It's a very small minority position that Price holds, that the entire testimonium was invented by later Christians. The majority view of scholars, and they have good reason to believe this, is that we have an original reference to Jesus, but that it was enhanced by later Christians. And that's the position we take in Creating Christ. Okay. The James reference is almost universally regarded as authentic, although a couple of scholars, and I do mean just a couple of fringe cranks, really, dismiss the whole James thing as an interpolation. I would cite Richard Carrier on this, but Richard Carrier is a mythicist who needs every reference of Josephus to be gone for his mythicism. So, and I think his agenda is controlling his warped view of that passage. And I debated Richard Carrier on this very point, the James passage, earlier in a previous podcast. But that, again, Carrier's position is a really ultra small minority. Josephus appears to have mentioned Jesus, and he appears to have mentioned John the Baptist, James, and from what I can tell, Jesus, but not in a negative fashion, which is a really interesting thing. John the Baptist and James, for example, passages which are almost universally regarded to be authentic to Josephus, still whitewash those characters. Messianic Jews in the pre-war era, figures that Josephus would normally be very critical of. These crazy madmen rebels, these innovators. Of course, they were probably the most ultra-conservative Jewish faction of the time, the rebels. They were Torah Orthodox nationalist separatists. And for us to consider them as some innovators like Josephus is saying. But no, it goes beyond that. Josephus, forget the mentions of Jesus. Josephus says that Vespasian is the Messiah of prophecy. The emperor Vespasian is the Messiah of prophecy. Furthermore, when he describes the siege of Jerusalem, he actually describes an army fighting in the clouds. He says, as crazy as this sounds, believe it or not, folks, there was seen at the siege of Jerusalem in 70 AD, there was seen armies fighting in the clouds. Well, that's a clear reference to Daniel and the Son of Man prophecy from the prophet Daniel, which is a messianic prophecy. So he's saying that the fulfillment of the messianic prophecy has occurred. He's using Hebrew scripture to establish his point that a Roman emperor is the true Jewish Messiah and that the Jewish rebels got it all backwards. In fact, back it up. When Josephus goes over to the Roman side, he says he has prophetic dreams and a vision that tell him that God has gone over to the Roman side. He's still a good Jew. He believes in the one true God, but that he's got that God, our Jewish God, has gone over to the Roman side, which is really quite an extraordinary claim. Yeah. And besides, in choosing Josephus, a Jewish scholar, as their chief author for their war, he wrote the Jewish War, the Flavians' chief propaganda device telling the story of how they defeated the Jews in the first Jewish War. Why did you choose a Jew? No, the Romans are using Jewish religion on purpose. For their own propagandistic purposes. But this, of course, would be typical of the Romans.
Yeah.
It's adapted every religion of the ancient East, Eastern Mediterranean. They've got Persian Mithra. They've got Egyptian gods like Isis and Serapis, temples of them in Rome. We, of course, the Greek religion they completely adopted, or the great mother of the Phrygians. So nearly every one of the Eastern Mediterranean religions, even their enemy Parthian religion, was adopted and transformed by the Romans into their own thing, if you will. There's a Roman version of each of those cults. And so it would be a lacuna if there was no Roman version of Judaism, or Messianic Judaism in particular, given the context of the first and second centuries.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Well, yeah, when they did, because I know when they did take over, they'd allow the religion to stay versus just kicking it out and then, yeah, essentially rewrite it in their own way. I want to kind of backtrack for a second. Can you characterize the Judaism of the first century? How much did the Hasmonean revolt, the Hanukkah miracle, lead to the Roman conquest of Judea and then the rise of Judaism in the Second Temple? Well, I guess the first century period there, because, you know, Jews believe that Messiah would come to liberate them from Roman rule. How much of this played into the cultural matrix of Judaism in the first century?
Well, you hit it right on the head. The cultural corruption of Hellenism, well, after the conquests of Alexander the Great, obviously, Greek ideas are being now spread throughout the world that Alexander has conquered, so that the last dynasty of Egyptian pharaohs is Macedonian, and they've introduced Greek culture, and now Egyptian culture is a blend of Greek and Egyptian culture. The same is going on in Syria. The same is going on in, throughout the world of Alexander's conquests. The most resistant group, culturally speaking, to any Greek influence were the Jews. And that explains, of course, the Hanukkah revolt, the Maccabean revolt. They wanted to push out the Syrian, Seleucid, Hellenistic influence and return to a more purify the temple of that defilement and get back to a more Torah Orthodox worship of their God. And so they had the successful Maccabean revolt. And that set the agenda. The last independent kingdom of Jews in the ancient world, the Hasmonean kingdom of the second and first centuries BC, the Romans come in, of course, and dominate the area. And starting with that Roman domination, they set up their own client kings, converts, Arab converts to the Jewish religion, to be their client kings in the area, who must be deeply resented by these same conservative factions that had rebelled against cultural assimilation of Greek ideas earlier. And so what's particularly paradoxical about Christianity is that it not only combines Judaism, you can imagine, we already have examples of Greek ideas and Jewish ideas being fused in the philosopher Philo, for example, of the first century. That Platonic Judaism influence, integration, if you will, is already going on, but it's not yet Christianity. What we see with Christianity is something that's a really interesting twist. It's messianism. It's apocalyptic messianism of the kind that we read in the sectarian Dead Sea Scrolls that appears to be being turned on its head.
Yeah.
Which is sort of a paradoxical mix. The people who should be most resisting assimilation, the Jewish rebels, the Jewish messianic types, are their form of Judaism is exactly what's being transformed by Christianity. Because we do know there are different sects of Jews at this time. Philo and Josephus and others do describe the different sects of Jews in the first century. We have the Sadducees, who appear to be Torah Orthodox. They only really go by Torah, and they distrust something like Daniel, and because it seems to suggest immortal soul and a final judgment of souls. And we're told that the other groups, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, the Pharisees and the Essenes, do believe in an immortal soul. Now, imagine, if you will, the destruction of the temple in 70. No longer can the high priest enter the Holy of Holies on Yom Kippur and ask God for forgiveness of the people's sins. No longer can we do the animal sacrifices prescribed in Mosaic law. This is now a crisis for those Jews who do believe in an immortal soul. Their redemptive mechanism, the temple itself, has been destroyed. They need an alternate redemptive mechanism. And that is, of course, Jesus. Jesus is specifically compared to the temple. Jesus is, his death on the cross is specifically compared to animal sacrifices under the Mosaic law. He's the Lamb of God at Passover. So he replaces the animal sacrifices. He is the new temple. Destroy this temple and I shall build another one in 3 days, says Jesus. So the Paul even says Jesus is the foundation of a new temple, which is interesting. So Jesus as the new redemptive mechanism for those Jews who believe in an immortal soul is the essence of the theology of Christianity. And nothing I say contradicts that at all. There's some people get the wrong idea here. Nor do we really believe that there's any conspiracy. All of these facts were well known. It's a question of who was writing the New Testament and what was their agenda. There were many, let me put it this way, there were many people in the Roman world, non-Jews, Gentiles, who were attracted to monotheism. Monotheism, for philosophical reasons, was becoming more and more attractive. Platonism and Neoplatonism is far more consistent with monotheism than it is with polytheism at the end of the day, as philosophers like Philo or the pagan Plotinus in the second century really make clear. And so these philosophical monotheists are being attracted, these Gentile philosophical monotheists are being attracted to Jewish monotheism. And there's a whole category known as God-fearers, people who maybe aren't getting circumcised and really entering the house of Israel, but still wanting to worship and study the Jewish God. There were also elite Jews working with the Romans. I think this is important, like Josephus, for example, or like Philo and his family, who were Roman tax collectors in Alexandria, Egypt. These people would have very pro-Roman sympathies. They're doing very well under the Romans, thank you very much. And they are very they think these rebels are just a bunch of mad kooks. So if you're doing well under the Romans, and you're one of these educated elites like Philo or Josephus, you'd be on the Roman side of things. These folks got to be looking for a new way to assimilate with the Roman world. So between the Gentiles who want to be, who are interested in monotheism, and between elite Jews working with the Romans, there is a constituency here behind Christianity. And I believe that it's really impossible to miss that that's our constituency for Christianity. It was not aimed originally to convert the whole Roman Empire. But the formula they created there was such a powerful one. It combined Jewish monotheism with an open door. You don't have to get circumcised. Anyone can join, right? Policy. It was so open to everyone. And yet it combined this monotheistic idea that could unify an empire, which the Romans were very much interested in doing. It became too irresistible. Christianity was had the right formula and it took over the empire. But you made a great historical point earlier. You'll note that throughout Christian history, there's all kinds of anti-Semitism. I mean, you sneeze in the wrong direction. Let's go kill a bunch of Jews. You show a passion play and that's an excuse half the time to go, kill a bunch of local Jews. Whereas the Roman Empire was venerated. It was the Holy Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. And it only went out of existence at the time of Napoleon, 200 years ago. So the Christians venerated the Roman Empire, even as they were attacking Jews for most of its history.
It was very odd. When you think of the text, it comes from, Israel in the Middle East. It's Jewish by nature. And then the book becomes, at least the New Testament becomes about Roman ideas. It fits very in with the Roman culture. They idolize Rome and definitely anti-Jewish, very anti-Jewish.
Oh, and increasingly anti-Semitic. The original documents are increasingly ferocious in their anti-Semitism, as far as I can tell. But from the outset, it was anti-Jewish nationalism. It was anti-Jewish separatism. It was anti-Torah. It was Torah critical. Paul is beginning to peel off, we don't have to worry about kosher diet or circumcision. More than that, we're worshiping a God man. Mm. More than that, we're drinking his blood. We're drinking blood. Now, under normal Torah sensibilities, that's anathema in the extreme, or a human God-man. Now, previous Jewish conceptions of the Messiah might believe that he was a special guy. There might be miracles. Moses, David, I mean, there were miracles associated with things they did, but he's a man, he's not God. The Messiah being identified as God, as Christian literature increasingly does, first they suggest he's God. Jesus can forgive sins. He's born of a virgin, you know, that kind of thing to tell us, oh yeah, he is God. But by the time you get to the Gospel of John, it is absolutely plain Jesus is God, or form of God. He was the Word. He was with God and was there at the creation, and a pre-existent being that you can almost identify with God. And also, by the time you get to John, the Jews and Judas were simply possessed by the devil. That's how anti-Semitic we're getting by the time of John.
Quite striking. Okay, so you mentioned like the messianism of the Dead Sea Scrolls. I guess, what do you make of the Zealots and the Zechari, the Essenes? They were essentially separatist at Qumran. How that their views may have influenced the historical Jesus, James's community. And in contrast, what do you make of the Roman provenance of the New Testament? Like, where are things you can see an anti-Jewish sentiment that kind of goes against those kind of messianic ideals?
Well, the entire conception of Messiah is a revolutionary one in the Greek Christian texts. It's not anything like what you read about in the Dead Sea Scrolls, for example. I am a deep admirer of Professor Robert Eisenman's work. I disagree with him on a couple of matters, such as the dating of most of the scrolls and on the identifications of persons. Paul is the liar and so forth. But he makes a devastating point that I think is hard to argue against. The very language and poetic imagery of the Dead Sea Scrolls sectarians is picked up in the New Testament by Paul's very language. Take, for example, the grape, it's the battle hymn of the Republic, right? The grapes of wrath, right? That God is pouring out. Well, that image we used to think came from Paul. No. With the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls in the middle of the 20th century, we learned that that very image, the cup of God's wrath, the grapes of God's wrath, was Dead Sea Scrolls poetry. So Christianity is keying off of not only messianic ideology, not only the same apocalyptic belief in the coming of the Messiah that so animates the Dead Sea Scroll sectarians, but it does, and the Dead Sea Scroll sectarians are militant, nationalist, separatists. We have found fragments of sectarian scrolls at Masada. At Masada, the last battle of the first Jewish war in the first century, those rebels at Masada venerated the sectarian Dead Sea Scrolls. So there's a connection between the rebels and the scrolls community, and there's a connection between early Christian literature as early as Paul and the sectarian scrolls community. So in the sectarian scrolls community, I think we get a good idea of what the Roman period Jewish messianic religion would have looked like. They are intensely Torah Orthodox, intensely separatist, intensely religious. They are, in effect, in some ways, the model of Christianity, and in other ways, the diametric opposite. Jesus stomps on all the purity regulations in the Gospels that he can possibly find. He touches every impure graven image. Show me the money and he touches it. Oh, yeah, hang out with unclean people. Great. I'm going to flaunt every purity regulation that the Essenes appear to take extremely seriously and the Dead Sea Scrolls community appear to take very, very seriously. Yeah. And yet, on the other hand, it contains powerful elements of Essene ideology, holding property in common, taking care of the poor, healers, people who are setting themselves apart separately in a monastic sort of setting, some of them celibate. If all those elements, seem to be the predecessors to Christianity are there, then it's a very curious, as I say, again, paradoxical combination of elements. In the Greek New Testament, Jesus says, this is the interesting thing. If we divorce it from its political context, some of these statements don't make really any sense. Jesus will say things like, whoever uses a sword shall die by the sword. Well, lots of people who use weapons die of natural causes. Lots of people who kill will die of natural causes. So literally what Jesus is saying makes no sense. In the context of Jewish rebellion, it makes perfect sense as a dire warning. Don't rebel against Rome. Or take the whole Jesus apocalypse. Jesus allegedly, this is why most scholars, and I'm included in that, believe that the Gospels must postdate the Jewish war and the destruction of the temple. Jesus gives a detailed prediction of the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple, which fits perfectly Josephus's description of the event, including the armies in the clouds. So and it becomes clear to me that Jesus, again, is being given a prediction of dire warning to the Jews. Don't rebel. It will cause the destruction of the temple. Jesus, over and over, Jesus is saying, peace, go the extra mile for the Romans. He's making friends with tax. One of his disciples is a tax collector. He says, render unto Caesar. You see, what is the rebel's position? You can't be a good Jew and a loyal Roman. Well, Jesus is saying just the opposite. You can render unto God what's God's, and you can render unto Caesar what's Caesar's. Flying in the face of the very rebel philosophy. Jesus says of a centurion, not just a Roman in this time of Jewish war, but a Roman centurion, that he has more faith than any Jew. Paul's letters are probably earlier material. At Romans 13, one of the so-called authentic Pauline letters, he says the Roman government are God's, not just it's a good idea to, you know, obey the law because we don't want to get in trouble, you know, get along and go along. No, no, no. Paul says the Roman government are God's appointed agents on earth. It is sin to violate the law. It is sin to rebel. It is sin not to pay your taxes. We don't just pay our taxes to the Romans to get along with the Romans. No, no, as practical advice or something. No, no, no. We pay because God orders us to. I think we have a very shallow and simplistic view of both Jews and Romans of the period. They had a wide variety of viewpoints. There was a spectrum of Jewish opinion at the time, and there was a spectrum of Roman opinion at the time. So, for example, criticism of Romans that you might find in the Gospels is perfectly consistent with criticism that the Romans issued against themselves. People are familiar, for example, with Suetonius's biography, second century biography of the first 12 Caesars. He's highly critical of Caligula and Nero, and all those nasty stories we hear about these madmen emperors come from pagan Romans. And what's funny too is that a lot of the critical stuff about Herod that we read in the God, well, how could this be? The Herods are pro-Rome. Well, no, Josephus is critical of the Herodian rule. He gives Herod the Great a grisly death because he's a sinner. So Romans could criticize the Herods, who were their client kings, right? And they could criticize their own emperors. And within the Jewish community, you had that same sort of interplay. But nonetheless, if you were to tell me, wait a minute, there's this really cataclysmic conflict, a series of conflicts between Jews and the Roman Empire in the first and second centuries. All of our sources, both Jewish and pagan, say it was messianic prophecies that motivated this rebellion. Josephus, Johanan ben Zakkai, Suetonius, Tacitus, they're all agreed pretty much on this point. And if that's the case, then could it be an accident or a mere coincidence that Christianity emerged at exactly this time and was predicated on the messianic version of the religion, only it turned it on its head into a pro-peace version with all these Greco-Roman religious elements like man-god and so forth? It's a form of Neoplatonism taken to the extreme, Christianity. It's not just Jewish Platonism like in Philo. It's highly Roman propagandized political Greco-Roman philosophy layered up paradoxically onto the most messianic version of it. Does that make sense?
It does. So, within the early Christian movement, there were Nazarene and Ebionites. And they tend to be the Ebionites rejected Paul's message totally. The Nazarenes, I think they embraced it a little bit, and they were the what they call Jewish Christians who kind of stayed within Judaism. And then, you know, you have other branches of Christianity that kind of break off. I
saw a statement with the more authentic Jewish Christian Jesus movement before the Romans got their hands on it, looked like it's the Ebionites. They call themselves the poor, which seems to be code language that goes all the way back to the Dead Sea Scrolls sectarians. And so, yeah, that's why, in fact, it's the existence of things like the Ebionites that convinces me there was a authentic Jesus movement. And that authentic Jesus movement, look, it's plain that Jesus was Torah Orthodox. Whatever the Gospels say, the Gospels are simply trying to prove that Paul was right in his debate among the Jesus movement. We read in Paul's letters, specifically in the book of Galatians, Paul has a fierce argument with the existing Jesus movement over circumcision and eating with Gentiles. And that fierce argument, does Paul say, oh, remember what Jesus said? No. He says, I got it from no man. I got it. Paul says, I got this message from my own revelation. And Jesus's brother and best friend disagree with me about it. Mm-hmm. This clearly suggests that Paul is the creator of the anti-Torah stuff in Christianity, and that the original Jesus movement was at least Torah Orthodox. And because why would you, this is the standard Christian explanation. Well, James and Kephas went back to Jewish ways after the Jesus of the Gospels had criticized Torah. Why would James and Kephas have such a fierce argument? They would have said, okay, yeah, you and your Gentile mission can do that. After all, Jesus had given us the green light. But no, Paul never cites Jesus. He could have won the argument just by quoting one of those famous, Jesus in the gospel says, nothing you put into your body is impure or defiles. It's what comes out of your body. So he's attacking the whole of kosher diet. Yeah. He's attacking the whole purity regime. And so under Mosaic law, Jesus, the historical Jesus, could not have credibly said that. Jesus and his first followers were Torah Orthodox, and there was a movement of original Jesus followers, I think, and the Ebionites demonstrate that, I think, and among other things. I do believe there's a historical Jesus for other reasons, largely Bart Ehrman's reasons. He is Paul, the first quote Christian writer, does believe in a historical Jesus. Josephus mentions him in the first century. I think we have plenty of evidence. More than that, why would you invent a simple fact like dude crucified under Pilate? Unless there's a reason to believe that would be invented, I'm going with a dude was crucified under Pilate. But if he was crucified for being a credible heir to David and therefore one a political threat to the Romans.
Well, so you went where I was going to go with my question, and it was about, well, I saw a church father statement that said the Ebionites were a branch of Essenes, so that was kind of where that is. But my question was about the schism between Paul and the community of James and Peter, which I see situated with the Ebionites, and then Paul's writings, the Hellenistic influence message that becomes more part of the Gentiles and Rome. How do you see, like within the text, what do you see that speaks to that narrative that says, one, Paul is, you know, in contradiction to, I guess, the Ebionite or the earlier Jewish Christian message?
Well, the whole thrust, in my view, there are two basic thrusts to Paul's work. One is we can admit Gentiles without them being circumcised or complying with kosher diet. They can become full members of the house of Israel, total Jews, and they don't have to be circumcised. They don't have to comply with kosher diet. The specifics of Mosaic law need not apply to them. Wow. The other thing, which is, if you think about it all by itself, a remarkable thing, the inclusion of Gentiles. But more than that, at least the later Pauline works, and some might argue that it's the pseudo-Pauline works of later Christians, that begin to say, well, it has nothing to do with being good or bad at all, but simply faith in Jesus. So we can chuck the entire Torah, in effect. I mean, there's morality in there in Paul. You know, don't be sexually licentious. You know, don't be greedy, help the poor. So there's a lot of moral advice there, but that moral advice doesn't really seem to be it seemed to be pretty vaguely based on Torah. You know, and we can see that Christians quickly abandon any strict Torah observance. They're using graven images to depict God and Jesus. They're using, you know, they completely reject the Hebrew calendar. You have to ask yourself, why are they just simply adopt the Roman calendar and all this Roman symbolism? One of the other things that we point out in Creating Christ is that the earliest Christian symbols are pagan symbols, graven images, and adopted from these Flavian emperors who claimed to be the true Jewish messiahs and had a Jewish propagandist making that case for them. The only emperors who used that very symbol were emperors who fought Jewish wars. Titus and Hadrian. So when you look at it that way, there and in the earliest catacombs, the very same symbols, anchors and fish, are used in preference to crosses, mind you. Now, there is textual grounds for this. Jesus's followers were fishermen. We're told, I'll make you fishers of men and so forth. And of course, there's the famous, you know, name game with Jesus's titles spelling out ichthys fish in Greek. There is that, but it seems to be grounded in pagan ideology, or at least a blend of, say, the Jonah story. Jonah was 3 days in a large fish. Jonah was resisting God's call to go talk to the Ninevites, right? And so, and the sign of Jonah is mentioned in Christian literature. So 3 days in the fish is Jesus's 3 days before his resurrection and so forth, that connection. So, but there may have already been in among Jewish messianics a connection between Jonah and Jesus, but I could go on infinitely long, and I'm sure you don't have time with this, in terms of the specific textual materials that show both a bleed through of rebel ideas, but mostly turning those on its head to say the exact opposite, get along with, well, perhaps the most famous, Jesus is the Messiah, the King of the Jews. He is depicted as being like a slave, washing the feet of his disciples. The king is washing his disciples' feet. And he's saying in the same gospel, my kingdom is not of this earth. Okay, because after all, in the kingdom of God, Matthew and Mark say, the first shall be last and the last shall be first. You first century Jewish messianics, you got it all backwards. It's not here on earth. It's not being number one here on earth and kicking out the Romans. It's the afterlife that we should be exclusively focused on, nothing political here in the real world. Mm. Now.
Become good Roman citizens and don't cause trouble.
Bingo. It was an attempt in part, I don't know how successful it was, but it was an attempt in part, I think, to pacify militant Jews, the most militant elements of them, the messianic apocalyptic ones, using their own imagery and language, mind you, turned on its head, but also a way, as I say, for Gentiles who were interested in monotheism to join in without being one of these rebels that the Romans didn't trust. We have to find a way to accommodate these groups. And the Romans were experts at such ideological assimilation and accommodation.
Yeah, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. So, I mean, to characterize kind of what you're saying, the Hellenistic influences that you can see within Paul's message, accompanied with the growing like Gentile nature, I guess, of, you know, the early Christian movement. And I'm going to kind of get into this question a little bit. So Joseph Atwell, he taught in Caesar's Messiah, thinks that it's Titus is who really is the New Testament Messiah that they're writing about. But I would say it seems that you're just saying it was a kind of a general influence on the message to make them passive. Well, how would you respond, I guess, to Atwell's view and characterize kind of where your view is?
I have substantial agreement with some of what he says and substantial disagreement with what he says. He regards, for example, all four gospels as written in coordination with one another. I don't agree with that. I agree with the standard scholarly view that they were written for each written for a distinct community and at different times, and reworkings of earlier sources. I do not think that they came out as is in a four gospel coordinated fashion, which is what Atwell seems to argue. For example, and that's just one example, I don't agree with every single one of his parallels between Titus and Jesus. And I believe that there are a lot more parallels other than Titus that are involved. Vespasian, for example, is said to have performed miracles identical to some of the healing miracles that Jesus performs. And so I think Vespasian's a model. More than that, I agree with the scholar Francesco Carota that Julius Caesar was a model in some respects for Jesus. I believe with Dennis MacDonald that Greek literature, Homer and Euripides, was used. Now, that would really be paradoxical for Jewish rebels, right? Jewish messianics, to be integrating Euripides and Homer into their work. I agree with Professor Robin Faith Walsh that the Gospels and the New Testament generally appear to have been written by Greco-Roman elites. But I don't necessarily think that the Gospels themselves were a government project of the Romans. I think their source material was. I think that a lot of there were times when the Roman government gave it the green light because they thought it was perfect for their ends. And then there were other times when they distrusted it. Within the Flavian movement, for example, the emperors Vespasian and Titus had a large group of elite Jews working around them, men like Josephus, people like the nephews of the philosopher Philo working with the Flavians. So Philo's family, Josephus himself, highly educated, elite Jews we're told the emperor Titus almost married the Herodian princess Berenike. He was that close with these Jewish elites, and he was claimed to be the Messiah, the Jewish Messiah. And he enters Jerusalem at the age of 30, fulfilling Jesus's destruction prophecy at the same age Jesus does. He descends from Galilee, just like Jesus descends from Galilee. And there are many other, he camps out on the Mount of Olives, just like Jesus camps out at the Mount of Olives. Now, there may be other reasons for some of that. The rebel movement of Judas the Galilean seems to have started and at least associated with Galilee. He's called Judas the Galilean, for example. The Mount of Olives also has messianic associations that predate Christianity. So some of this may not directly come from Titus, but it fits with Titus, if that makes sense. And Titus is beloved as an altruistic. He stripped his apartments of all their wealth, we're told by Suetonius, to help the poor, just like Jesus tells the rich young man to sell his possessions and help the poor. Josephus is down with ideas like that. He loves the Essenes' collective ownership of property and their taking care of the poor, even though Josephus was probably a pretty rich guy himself working for the Romans. Yeah. But nonetheless, the ideas of the New Testament don't stand out of standard Roman ideas at the time. For example, we can see in the famous nativity story in Luke, the angels come at the birth of Jesus and say, "Declare peace on earth, goodwill toward men." A very famous line from Luke's beautiful story of the birth of Jesus. Well, on Roman coins jingling in everybody's pockets in the first century, you can see Pax Orbis Terrarum, peace on earth, Roman propaganda, or Concordia, Harmonia. Peace on earth, goodwill toward men, Concordia, Harmonia, or even Clementia, mercy, on Roman coins. So, or Eternus, Spes, hope. You can see ideas that are repeatedly featured in the New Testament actually minted on Roman coins, which no one doubts is Roman propaganda.
Yeah.
And what another interesting thing is that in one of Paul's authentic letters, for example, you know, some of Paul's letters are recognized as pseudo-epigrapha. They claim to be written by Paul, but probably were not written by Paul. But the so-called authentic letters of Paul, one of them is Philippians, and he boasts about his connections with the Praetorian Guard. He says, "I have got such access to everyone in the Imperial Guard, none of them haven't heard of the message of Jesus." In the same letter, he says, "Oh, and greetings from Caesar's household."
Oh, wow.
In the same letter, he appears to be mentioning Epaphroditus and Clement, who are important Roman figures during the Flavian administration. In the last chapter of Romans, he says, "Greet my kinsmen Herodian and in the house and say hi to the household of Aristobulus. Those sound like royal Herodian names. Mm-hmm. And when you read the tradition in Acts, it's Roman governors who are constantly saving, or Roman administrators who are constantly saving Paul as some Torah Orthodox Jewish crowd is out to get Paul. Mm. Because Paul is trying to say, out the door with Torah. You can imagine he's got a group of Orthodox Jews following him saying, you're no real Jew. And so that's what Acts presents. Acts presents us with a story of Roman officials intervening to protect Paul from Torah Orthodox Jewish crowds. And that makes a lot of sense historically, too, even if I don't regard Acts as a historically accurate document. The tradition about Paul is that he was a Roman citizen. He was given a trial before Herod Agrippa II and his sister Berenike, and then he was sent to Rome. Well, not every Roman citizen even gets that kind of treatment. And it seemed they sent, in the book of Acts, the Romans sent out a whole cohort of the army to protect Paul from the Jewish plot to kill him.
Yeah, compelling evidence. I mean, so what do you think happened to the Ebionites or the Torah Orthodox, the original followers? I would contend that, like, Constantine, the Council of Nicaea, the Edict of Milan, as it becomes, part of the Roman government, they do kind of go on a violent path of subduing
other heretics ruthlessly. Yeah. Is, I think, the nicest way I have of putting it. That once the Christians take over, and the point is, it does. It's so hand in glove, isn't it? The Roman government could so easily, so pro-Roman, Christianity is so pro-Roman, that the Roman government could easily step into that shoe when it becomes popular. But in the second and third centuries, there was a variety of Christianities. It's hard to even pin down something and call it Christianity in the second and third centuries. You've got Gnostics, you've got Proto-Arians, you've got Marcionites, you've got the different communities of the different Gospels, for example. So you've got Christianity spreading out and doing its own thing in various places in the Roman Empire. When it becomes the official, and by the third century, they're clearly a political constituency. You know, it's only then that they start having conflicts with other religious groups like the Saul Invictus people, when they become a real political constituency. And you've got, we know of large numbers of Christians in the Roman army by the end of the second century under Aurelius, which is a remarkable fact. But by the end of the third century, they're a total political constituency that Constantine is using and using them to his political advantage. And so while we're told he only converts on his deathbed, in the famous legend, he certainly legalizes it, calls the council, empowers these Christians to call a Council of Nicaea, create a uniform Christianity, and so in short order, when the Constantine dynasty makes it the official religion of the empire, we need one uniform code, and every variant is going to be stamped out ruthlessly. It is a miracle that rabbinic Judaism survived itself, but the reason why it survived, it was the form of Judaism least like Christianity. In an ironic twist, they're very special people. That's where we come from. We understand that. But they are politically not so threatening as these messianic types. See, your Ebionites. See, and I don't believe it was fully stamped out, though. I think that hardcore militant messianic Judaism found further future expressions. Islam regards Jesus as a prophet. Islam is highly militant and ultra orthodox about certain things like graven images, about not eating pigs, about, and so, wow, it seems as though a variant of our rebels did survive. A variant of our Jesus movement did sort of continue to influence things. So while you're absolutely right, when the Constantines take over the empire, they enforce an orthodoxy, and they're going to wipe out Pelagians who believe in free will, Gnostics who have these crazy ideas. They're going to discourage Arianism, although that's going to be a hard one to stamp out. But nonetheless, there's still, I think, forms of it that go underground and still pop up in later forms, if that makes sense. And I would cite Islam as one of them. A strange corruption of the Jesus movement, true, but clearly one based on what I think was more the militant Torah Orthodox Jesus movement, the authentic Jesus movement of the first century.
Yeah, you're probably onto something there. No, the Ebionites, so into the 8th century, Ebionites still kind of existed. And from my research into the birth of Islam and their view of who Jesus was, it was the Ebionites who influenced their view of who Jesus was as a man and a prophet.
Yes,
so
sir.
I don't know if you've done any research in that, but no, it's actually
not my field of expertise. It's not my field of expertise, but I certainly have read enough to believe that that is a strong hypothesis, my friend.
Yeah.
The connections.
I've talked to Muslims who agreed with that as well.
The connections are too many to ignore, really.
Yeah. So, yeah, quite interesting. Some very good points. I really appreciate you taking the time to do interview with me today.
I think one of the things that people have to realize, and Christians, obviously, there's been a tremendous amount of, you know, since the Enlightenment, the Christian world has become more humane, if I can just make a general point here. And certainly after the Holocaust, there was a lot of well-earned Christian guilt. And I think that in recent years, in recent centuries even, Christians have realized the disconnect between their religion and authentic Judaism. And so they've been attempting to re-Judaize their religion. And so, well, let's look at Hollywood. You look at the Jesus stories, they take out all this stuff that blames the Jews from their passion narrative. You remember when Mel Gibson did his film, The Passion, when he included the "His blood is on us," rabbis went crazy. And so he refused to translate, you know, it was in Aramaic, and he with English subtitles. So he still has them saying it in Aramaic. He just doesn't, the subtitle, the "His blood is on us and on our children." So Christians, the ones in the 60s and 70s, completely toned down the anti-Semitism of the gospel stories in their movies. Mel Gibson kind of restored it a little bit, which is very, very interesting. But the fact of the matter is, no matter how Christians slice it, Christianity bears the same relation to authentic Judaism that, say, Taco Bell does to authentic Mexican food.
Does that make sense? That's a good point. It makes a good point. Sorry, I laugh, but yes.
No, but does that kind of make sense?
I mean, you know, Taco Bell's
for a foreign taste, so it's sort of like a form of it for a foreign taste accommodated to their foreign palate and all blanded out and standardized for mass consumption.
makes perfect sense, yeah.
My final thought.
Okay, yeah, no, I
appreciate it. I know your audience is interested in the relationship between Judaism and Christianity, and that's sort of the way I'd summarize it.
The original followers, you know, like you pointed out, the Ebionites, they were Jewish. They stayed Jewish. Paul's message definitely had that Hellenistic thing. And whether the government directly influenced or indirectly influenced, it was influenced by Roman thoughts and became something different. So, yeah, and I appreciate that summary. So.
The degree of the Roman government's actual influence varied, I think, from administration to administration. I think it's hard to deny that, for example, we see a literary renaissance and an era of toleration of Christianity, which claims to have been persecuted by the Romans, under several emperors, starting with Vespasian and Titus, Hadrian. Then there were other emperors, like Domitian, who was a Flavian, by the way, who turned on the Christian elements within the Roman court. We hear stories of Domitian executing his own cousin for adopting Jewish ways. And this guy's name is Clemens, Titus Flavius Clemens. And tradition has it that his wife's tomb, the catacombs of Domitilla, are the oldest physical evidence of Christianity we have. There may be an etch mark, mind you, some graffito in Pompeii, but it's controversial. The real clear evidence we have, first physical evidence of Christianity, is in the oldest of the Roman catacombs, which is identified both as an imperial Flavian site and a Christian site with the same symbols, the anchor and the fish.
Well said. Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate it. And you know, maybe we can do this again sometime, but I appreciate
you. I've enjoyed this a lot. Let's do it again if we can.
Yeah, sounds good. All right. Well, thank you very much. And enjoy the rest of your day, and I hope you feel better.
You too. Take care.